Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to UF Tretomy Radio. And tonight we're going to be doing a special edition. We don't normally have a show on Tuesday. But after a phone conversation with Gary Hunt one day, we decided that we just needed to have a show about the hypocrisy and the contradictions in the ruling of Judge Susan in the, what is it, the 9th District Court?
Yes.
In the 9th District Court. And they're not going to be looking at that, at her ruling and what she said. Now, we're going to be going through it and analyzing it, as well as we're going to look into the question of whether she even has the authority to make a ruling in this case, or did she overstep her bounds? Is this even the right court that these questions should be addressed in? So with that being said, I'd like to introduce Gary Hunt. Welcome on. Welcome to the show, Gary. How are you doing?
Thank you. Fine. Ready to go. First, though, I'd like to say a couple things. One is I am not an attorney. There are two books, and I don't know how many newspaper articles that claim that I was an attorney from Florida because I had the power of attorney from David Koresh, but I am not an attorney. I did study law for a while, and I got to the ethics class and decided I was going to be a surveyor instead of a lawyer. But I have studied the law. Nobody's well-versed in the law, but one thing that's happened over the years is law school students, like medical students are not taught holistic medicine. They're taught chemical treatment of disease, not preventive medicine, but preventive chemical treatment of disease. Likewise, lawyers are taught administrative law and plea bargaining. They're not taught the law. As we get into this, one thing I noticed, and I've left most of the sites out in what I'm going to present out of the order from Susan Bolton, but I found it interesting that most of the cases cited were after the year 2000. There are quite a few, or a number of cases from the 1990s, but there's no old cases in there. And I find that rather interesting. And for those that are interested, if you go to, well, I'll post the link in a few minutes. I did an article about Ashwander versus TVA. It was a 1937 Supreme Court decision where the Supreme Court said that they will not rule on the constitutionality of a matter before that court unless they have no recourse but to rule on the constitutionality. And they listed seven different items, six of them being the other excuses they can use, standing, somebody is subject to an administrative agency, all the ways they can get out of ruling on the constitutionality. So understand, since 1937, there are very few cases that have really addressed the constitutionality of the subject matter before the court. That being said, the injunction, maybe we ought to start with the injunction and what Randy just mentioned on the legitimacy of the injunction. I've got to find an email I got from a friend of mine down in Phoenix who contacted one of the attorneys working with the state. John Bouma, B-O-U-M-A, is apparently working with Brewer and the state regarding this, and I don't know if he was the author of the bill or not, or helped in the authoring of the bill. But he addressed the email that was going around regarding original jurisdiction, 28 U.S. Code, and then he cites here, he said to my friend, thank you for sending this. The lady in Canada Press is correct that the Supreme Court does not have original jurisdiction, but exclusive jurisdiction. And then it says, here's the statute showing the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisdiction as stated by Congress. 28 U.S. Code, Section 1251, Original Jurisdiction. The Supreme Court shall have original and exclusive jurisdiction of all controversies between two or more states. The Supreme Court shall have original but not exclusive jurisdiction of all actions or proceedings to which ambassadors or other public ministers, that's one. Number two, all controversies between the United States and the state. And three, all actions proceeding by a state against the citizens of another state or against aliens. Now, so the code he cited that he said gives original but not exclusive jurisdiction, excuse me, which is kind of interesting because it seems if the original jurisdiction is there, that a case would have to originate there. Now, but then it goes on. The Supreme Court shall have original and exclusive jurisdiction of all controversies between two or more states. But then B, the Supreme Court shall have original but not exclusive jurisdiction of all controversies between the United States and a state. So I'm not really sure what original is, and I haven't had a chance to go back and look into that. But it seems to me that if original means what original means, then the origin of the suit has to be in the Supreme Court. But that was an attorney saying that the lady in Canada was wrong. Now, I don't know if he sent the part about invasion or not, and I've been stressing, and I think we all need to, we keep talking about immigration. We need to start talking about invasion. Call it what it really is. It's not immigration, it's an invasion. And if it's an invasion, then it's a whole different ballpark than an immigration issue. Now, if you got five people sneak over the border, that's illegal immigration. If you have thousands coming over the border, that's an invasion. If you've got thousands supported by armed, uniform people, that's an invasion. It's not immigration. But SB 1070, which is what we're going to talk about tonight, addresses immigration. It doesn't address invasion, so we'll stick to immigration at this point.
Well, you're right there. Hey, do you mind if I cut in there for a second? You're very right there about the difference between an immigration problem and an invasion. There is a big difference between 100 people coming across the border in an hour, unarmed, and there's a difference between 100 people coming across the border in military uniforms or paramilitary uniforms and military-grade weapons. There's a big difference.
Well,
one is an illegal immigration problem. The other one is a paramilitary force coming into our country.
Well, 100 people a day coming across the border. I said 5 or 10. 100 people a day. Now, if I wanted to take over China and they didn't allow me to cross the border with rifles, but I started sending people in there just, you know, like Muslims coming to America, and they get there, and then they can buy the rifles. They're an army that didn't transport their rifles with them, but they've been put in place behind enemy lines where they can do the most damage once they get a rifle in their hands, right? So when you have massive numbers, that is beyond legal immigration. And as we read these statutes, they talk about a person. So that, you know, would imply a small number, not massive numbers. Now, we've got 13 million illegal immigrants in this country right now, and I'm not sure how many, but I would guess between 9 and 12 million of those are Mexicans or South Americans. That's just not a few people. Now, we have a problem in dealing with it. There's a U.S. code that deals with it, and we'll talk about some of the code, but it deals with individuals. Now, if the government had been enforcing the law, we wouldn't have that many in here. But for whatever reason, when you've got millions of people, when you've got 3% of our population is the illegal immigrants, that's an invasion. That's a lot of people. So I think we need to consider very much from a patriot standpoint that we're dealing with an invasion, even though tonight we're going to be talking about immigration. And 100 a day is a lot. I mean, that's 36,500 a year, but you know, it's actually higher than that. It's well higher than that because they expect that we're getting close to a million a year right now, I guess, or over a million a year. It depends on whose numbers you want to listen to. So we're talking about 300 a day at least.
You know, I watched a video from a hidden camera on YouTube that ACM had put up.
Yeah.
And in the hour that I watched it, I must have counted at least 50 people coming across.
And that's only one crossing point.
And that was one crossing point, one camera, 1 hour. So, you know, the numbers are huge. A million people a year, plus.
Yeah,
and that's an estimation. We don't know. It could be much more than that.
Well, when you get the people in place, all you got to do, like I say, is give them a rifle. So how many of those are actually very sympathetic to the Zeta or to one of these cartels? It's becoming apparent the cartels want to take on the United States government. They want to regain what they lost when Santana got caught with his pants down by Sam Houston. And they've never really stopped trying to regain that. They've got their ass kicked a few times. But MECHA, M-E-C-H-A, I'm not sure what it I don't recall what it stands for, but I remember when I was in junior college that MECA was an organization of the Mexican students. I never went to their meetings or anything. I don't know if I would have been allowed or not. But from what I understand now is they are, along the lines of other organizations, true believers in the fact that California, or at least parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas were taken from them illegally, and that they have every right to take them back. And that seems, I don't know if that was true back in the 60s, but if that's the case, are they a foreign army because they think that they own a part of the United States and it's just a matter of putting rifles in their hands? And how many of the people coming across the border are going to tie up with the MECA and what's that other organization that's...
La Raza?
La Raza, yeah. La Raza, they
tie
up these organizations and they're going to become soldiers in this invading army. So we need to look. The government's not looking at it that way. The press is not looking at it that way, but we've got to look at it that way. Quite frankly, if we don't, we're going to lose the war with Mexico because the federal government will not fight it. And the only thing we can do is acting as individuals, which we have every right to do, to stop the flow and reverse it. Look what happened. One school in Phoenix reported they lost over half their students in 2 weeks as they fled to another state. I think, from what a friend of mine in Phoenix said, that most of them are going to Albuquerque. Means New Mexico might want to pass a law like Arizona did pretty soon. But the effect it's had on the economy is in Arizona is substantial, and the residual effect isn't going to show for a while. The one impact it's having economically on the schools is the schools get $35 a day per student, regardless of where they're from or what right they have to be in school, as long as they're enrolled in a 10 class. So the schools are going to lose all that money, but then they won't need as many teachers either. The residual effects, though, are going to be the reduction in welfare and food stamps or whatever the credit cards or whatever they're using now, hospital services that are given out for free and all that. Now, the residual is going to have a serious impact on Arizona, a very positive one in the near future. But the press is playing on the fact that, business is down in Mexican restaurants and stuff like that right now.
Well, you brought up New Mexico and the possible flight of these illegals to New Mexico, Albuquerque and stuff. That's where I grew up at. I was born there. Lived there for many, many, many years. And when I left New Mexico in 2006, I can tell you couldn't go very many places and find people that spoke English. For instance, if you go to a McDonald's, a Blake's Whataburger, a Sonic, Whataburger, or any of the other restaurant or any of the fast food places they have there, good luck finding anybody that speaks English. A friend of mine owned a lawn monitoring place, and they monitored alarms for Blake's Whataburger. He was telling me that when he would call into the Blake's Whataburger, he couldn't even, half the managers didn't speak English. He would call them about alarms that were going off, and they could not communicate effectively because even the managers didn't speak English. 25% of the kids in the schools do not speak English and will never speak English. I've met kids that graduated high school in Albuquerque, cannot speak English.
The old school got the $35 per student per day, though.
The school got their money.
Well, I'll tell you another interesting one. In Alamosa, Colorado, I lived there for about a year. I was working for a survey company there, and a guy that's been in that area his whole life was telling me that statistically, if you take the Mexican Americans that live there, 70% of them cannot speak fluent Spanish. However, seasonally, when the crops are coming in, you go to Walmart and you don't even hear English. The people don't understand English. So every store there has to be prepared for the farming season when everybody comes in and speaks Spanish, but the Mexican Americans there, most of them cannot carry a fluid conversation. They can get by. This one guy I worked with, Joe, was Mexican. His family's been in Colorado for 7 or 8 generations for a very long time. He knew a lot of words and phrases in Spanish, and he acted like he knew it, but I asked him how would you say this, and he'd fumble around a little bit and say, I don't know. And this was after this other guy told me that 70% of them cannot speak fluent Spanish. So it varies, but if Alamosa, if that area starts getting hit, it's going to be hell on the local Mexican-Americans because they won't be able to communicate with the people who came up from Mexico. Anyway, on to the order from Susan Bolton.
Okay, let's get to that.
The injunction, the government had asked for an injunction on a number of points on the bill. Bolton issued injunctions enjoining Arizona from acting these out. Four items. She says, applying the proper legal standards based upon a well-established precedent, the court finds that the United States is likely to succeed on the merits in showing that the following sections of SB 1070 are preempted by federal law. Now, first is ARS 11-105-1B, which is what the statute will be in Arizona revised statutes if it weren't enjoined, requiring that an officer make a reasonable attempt to determine the immigration status of a person stopped, detained, or arrested if there is a reasonable suspicion that the person is unlawfully present in the United States, and requiring verification of the immigration status of any person arrested prior to releasing that person. So it was a reasonable attempt to determine status unless they were arrested, and if they were arrested, it requires verification of status. That's what's not allowed. The next one not allowed, ARS Section 13-1509, which creates a crime for failure to apply for or carry alien registration papers, which we'll see down the road, is required by federal law already. ARS Section 13-2928C, creating a crime for an unauthorized alien to solicit, apply for, or perform work. Now, there are supposed to be federal laws against that, and ICE raids places in Texas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Illinois, California, Colorado, busting people that are working without permits. But they say that Arizona cannot do the same thing. Now, it's going to get interesting because you'll see as we go down that the government wants exclusive authority to enforce laws. And then the last one that was enjoined was ARS Section 13-3883A5, authorizing the warrantless arrest of a person where there is probable cause to believe the person has committed a public offense that makes the person removable from the United States. Now, if they're illegally, they're removable, but as you'll see when we get down a little further, the whole issue of arrest a person where there's probable cause. Anybody listening ever been arrested for not signing a ticket or arrested for failure to be a law enforcement officer? How about arrested, my favorite, arrested for resisting arrest? Not that you know what you were being arrested for when you were resisting it, but you were arrested for resisting it anyway. So those are the four that are enjoined. Now, here's an overview by Bolton of the federal immigration law. Congress has created and refined a complex and detailed statutory framework. Let me interrupt here. When she says complex, she means it. Regulating immigration. The federal immigration scheme is largely enacted through the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is 8 U.S. Code Section 1100, which empowers various federal agencies, including the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, and Department of State, to administer and enforce the immigration laws. Among its many provisions, the INA sets forth the conditions under which a foreign national may be admitted to and remain in the United States. The INA also contains an alien registration system intended to monitor the entry and movement of aliens in the United States. Various actions may subject an alien to being placed in removal proceedings, such as entering the United States without inspection, presenting fraudulent documents at a point of entry, violating the conditions of admission, or engaging in certain other prescribed conduct. Now, it says that they can be placed on removal status for entering the United States without inspection. Now, the illegal immigrants do not stop at the inspection station when they cross the border on those videos that you were talking about. So it would seem that they are may subject an alien to being placed on removal. Now, understand when I said complex laws, why would it say may subject an alien to being placed in removal proceedings? Why would they do that? If it's against the law, shouldn't it be shall be placed in removal proceedings? So why the ambiguity in the law to say may? Why did the discretion on the part of the government in the law to begin with to allow them to say, yeah, you can come in, no, you can't, with no foundation in law to support the methodology used in determination? Going on, violations of immigration laws may also be subject an alien to criminal sanctions. Unlawful presence in the United States is not a federal crime, although it may make the alien removable. Now, there she refers to two U.S. codes. The first one is, what is it, 8 U.S., or is it 8 U.S. Code Section 1182, which is titled Inadmissible Aliens. And then she refers to A6AI, which is A is illegal entrance and immigration violators. The next A is aliens present without admission or parole. I is in general, which is one that she refers to, and it says an alien present in the United States without being admitted or paroled, or who arrives in the United States at any time or place other than as designated by the Attorney General, is inadmissible. That means they can't be here. Is inadmissible. Any person present in the United States without being admitted or paroled who arrives in the United States at any time or place other than as designated by the Attorney General is inadmissible. Now, unless the Attorney General said these people can walk across the border down in Arizona, then they're inadmissible. They can't be here. The next one she refers to is Section 1227, deportable aliens. And she refers to a number of points here, A1, B, and C. Okay, A1, B, and C. Alien classes of deportable aliens. Any alien, including an alien crewman, in and admitted to the United States, shall, upon the order of the Attorney General, be removed if the alien is within one or more of the following classes of deportable aliens: inadmissible at time of entry or of adjustment of status, or violates status. Inadmissible aliens, any alien who at any time of entry or adjustment, or at the time of entry or adjustment of status, was within one or more of the classes of aliens inadmissible by the law existing at such time is deportable. Now, earlier, they're inadmissible if they're here illegally. Here it says they're deportable. That means if they're here illegally, they're deportable. And next is present in violation of law. Any alien who is present in the United States in violation of this chapter or any other law of the United States, or whose non-immigrant visa or other documentation authorizing admission into the United States as a non-immigrant has been revoked under Section 1201. Well, that doesn't apply to these because these people did, this addresses people who have overstayed their welcome. So, it is complex. It says may, but everything else seems to support that if they're here illegally, they are deportable.
That's what I understood from it, from the conversation that we had. I mean,
well, I hadn't looked up the codes then, but I was pretty sure because I looked them up a while back when I was doing an article. Okay, next she says, unlawful presence is an element of the federal crime of reentry after deportation. She refers to 8 U.S. Code Section 1326. So let's look at 8 U.S. Code 1326. It says, reentry of removed aliens, in general, subject to subsection of B of this section, any alien who has been denied admission, excluded, deported, or removed, or has departed the United States while an order of exclusion, deportation, or removal is outstanding thereafter. So somebody that's been here and before and been kicked out, they're supposed to keep a list of, which she didn't address, I don't think, in this. But then the next one referred to is 8 U.S. Code 1325. And so 1325 is improper entry by alien. Improper time or place, avoidance of examination or inspection, misrepresentation, and concealment of facts. Any alien who enters or attempts to enter the United States at any time or place other than as designated by immigration officers or eludes examination or inspection by immigration officers. These are so long and I've got them jammed in here with my notes. Enters or attempts to enter the United States at any time or place other than as designated by immigration officers two, eludes examination or inspection by immigration officers, or three, attempts to enter or obtains entry to the United States by willfully false or misleading representation or the willful concealment of material facts, shall, for the first commission of any such offense, be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 6 months, or both, or for a subsequent commission of any such offense, be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned. And it goes on, second offense would be $250 and up to 5 years in prison. Now, the question then is it a crime if it's only 6 months and $50?
$50.
Now, if a misdemeanor is a crime, then you can go to jail for it. It would seem that if there's a criminal penalty and time in jail, that it's not a civil, rather it's a criminal act. And so it's an acknowledgement that there's a crime, but the judge doesn't seem to see it the way that common sense might dictate. So anyway, going on, back to the order. Federal alien smuggling laws make it a crime to knowingly bring an unauthorized, unauthorized alien into the country, as well as to harbor such person or to facilitate unlawful immigration. Now, that means if there's two people, each one is assisting the other. So if there's two people, it's a crime. Now, obviously, if you catch them on the streets of Phoenix, you can't really prove that they came across together. So I can see a dilemma there in enforcing the law on the part of the federal government. They can't make the assumption that these people just randomly, one at a time, walked from Guatemala all the way to Phoenix with no assistance at all. But then Section 1324, Congress also created sanctions to be implemented against employers who knowingly employ aliens who are not authorized to work when it passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, the IRCA, in 1986. Federal law contains no criminal sanction for working without authorization, although document fraud is a civil violation under our IRCA. In 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act, IRA, which, among other things, created various employment eligibility verification programs. So this says it's a crime to work without papers, but earlier she enjoined Arizona from creating an identical law in Arizona statutes, which would give the police powers of the state the authority to enforce federal law, because everything here requires that you have permission. It does get complex. Now, then we get to what I mentioned, exclusive, and we'll get to that further on. Back to the injunction. Federal immigration law also envisions certain areas of cooperation in immigration enforcement among the federal government and state and local governments. It envisions certain areas of cooperation in immigration enforcement among the federal government and state and local governments. Then it says, see U.S. Code 8 U.S. Code Section 1357 G1 through 9. Now, G1 through 9 gets rather interesting. Let me see if I can find the bigger version of it.
You know, something I want to reiterate here is that everything that Arizona is trying to do so far that we've talked about is exactly what the federal laws state anyways.
Yeah, and the whole thing is going to hinge on the exclusive right. Okay, now here's 1 through 9, this one. Performance of immigration officers functions by state officers and employees. 1. Notwithstanding Section 1342 of Title 31, the Attorney General, there's one thing interesting about law. They keep referring to other places, go here, go there, and I didn't go to Title 31. The Attorney General may enter into a written agreement with a state or any political subdivision of a state pursuant to which an officer or employee of the state or subdivision who is determined by the Attorney General to be qualified to perform a function of an immigration officer in relation to the investigation, apprehension, or detention of aliens in the United States, including the transportation of such aliens across state lines to detention centers, may carry out such function at the expense of the state or political subdivision and to the extent consistent with state and local law. Well, they allow state and local law, but they get to qualify whether a state can do it because they have to have a written agreement, and then they have to determine if the person is qualified, which is where the complexity of law comes in. One individual, the Attorney General, gets to make all these qualification decisions. Eric Holder? Oh, well. 2, an agreement this subsection shall require that an officer or employee of a state or political subdivision of a state performing a function under the agreement shall have knowledge of and adhere to federal law relating to the function and shall contain a written certification that the officers or employees performing the functions under the agreement have received adequate training regarding the enforcement of relevant federal immigration laws. Well, they are complex, and I imagine it might require a class to understand that the Attorney General may do this and may do that and might think you're qualified and might not. You know, I think back to Federalist Papers when it was pointed out that if a law is something that we're expected to obey, how can we understand and obey a law that's extensive, convoluted, and constantly changing? Difficult. Okay, 3, in performing a function under this subsection, an officer or employee of a state or political subdivision of a state shall be subject to the direction and supervision of the Attorney General. Oh, So even though they may be qualified to do this, they're under the direction and supervision of the Attorney General. That's the green mail ties the government uses to control federal government. That's why you will not see your local governments change. There are so many strings. If they receive one penny, they're bound by those federal green mail strings. 4, in performing a function under this subsection, an officer or an employee of a state or political subdivision of the state may use federal property or facilities as provided in a written agreement between the Attorney General and the state or subdivision. So we don't have to give you a place to put them if we don't want to. See how much discretion is left to the Attorney General? 5, with respect to each officer or employee of a state or political subdivision who is authorized to perform a function under this subsection, the specific powers and duties that may be or are required to be exercised or performed by the individual, the duration of the authority of the individual, and the position of the agency of the Attorney General who is required to supervise and direct the individual shall be set forth in a written agreement between the Attorney General and the state or political subdivision. Wow, that's amazing. We can turn the law on and off as we see fit. What good is the law then if you can turn it on and off? But that's what that one said, isn't it?
That's what it said.
6, the Attorney General may not accept a service under this subsection if the service will be used to displace any federal employees. Well, I don't think what Arizona is doing anything to displace any federal employees. Actually, it might require more of them to do their job. Well, that aside. 7, except as provided in paragraph 8, an officer or employee of the state or political subdivision of a state performing functions under this subsection shall not be treated as a federal employee for any purpose other than for the purpose of Chapter 81 of Title 5 relating to compensation for injury and Section 261 through 2671 through 2680 of Title 28 relating to tort claims. 8, an officer or employee of the state or political subdivision of state acting under color of authority under this subsection or any agreement entered into under this subsection shall be considered to be acting under color of federal authority for purpose of determining the liability and immunity from suit of the officer or employee in a civil action brought under state or federal or state law. 9, nothing in this subsection shall be construed to require any state or political subdivision or state to enter into an agreement with the Attorney General under this subsection. Well, it can't require them in, but it can require them out, apparently, which is kind of interesting approach to the relationship between states and the federal government. Yes, we can let you in, but no, you can't decide to come in on your own. It's totally our discretion. Now, Bolton talked about 1 through 9, which I've just read, but you know, 10 gets rather interesting, and it's the last one in this subsection. It says, nothing in this subsection shall be construed to require an agreement under this subsection in order for any officer or employee of a state or political subdivision of a state, A, to communicate with the Attorney General regarding the immigration status of any individual, which means they can call the Attorney General and say, is this guy legal? Including reporting knowledge that a particular alien is not lawfully present in the United States, so they can say, we believe he's not here. You verify that. And B, otherwise, to cooperate with the Attorney General in the identification, apprehension, detention, or removal of aliens not lawfully present in the United States. Now, cooperation. Now, if I'm cooperating with you, Randy, does that mean that I have to call Randy and say, hey, Randy, you know, we agreed to pick all the red apples off the tree, and you're not here. Can I pick the red apple? Or if we're cooperating, can I just go out and pick the red apple when it's ripe?
Right.
So cooperation doesn't require any more than we'll work together as necessary, but it gives it appears to grant the authority. Otherwise, to cooperate with the Attorney General in the identification, apprehension, detention, or removal of aliens not lawfully present in the United States. that would seem that it would be permission for Arizona's SB 1070 right there in that single paragraph. But then I'm not a lawyer. I'm a dumb person.
Well, you know, if we look at the laws anymore, Minuteman and Loud Voice in Texas and Odie Brooks made a comment. I forgot which one made it. And I think all three of them referenced it. Common sense laws. We need to get back to that.
That's
you know, 2,000-page omnibus bills do not work. And if you look at what the Founding Fathers said, they said that all the laws and the Constitution shall be written in a way in which the most common, uneducated person could understand what the law was.
Right, and I think it was Madison that provided, I paraphrased the quote, that a law, if it's something that we're bound to abide by, has to be simple, understandable, can't be constantly changed, and it must be easily understood. But this
easily understood.
You know, I went through this section, and it says that all the powers in the Attorney General, but then down at the bottom it says, but not necessarily, because you can cooperate with him. I'll pick the apple, and I'll give it to you. I'll pick the apple, and I'll give it to you. So the way the laws are written is they become very subjective in their application. Which of these phrases do we want to use? Bolton, for example, decided not to use number 10 in the injunction. Number 10 is the one that seems to give Arizona permission to proceed. So it's a mess, but that's what we've come to. I was going to post, why don't you talk for a minute? I'm going to post two links on the chat.
Okay. You know, I wanted to mention about this that we had been talking about as well was the fact that everything that Arizona has stated that they're going to start enforcing or that they're capable of doing is everything that the federal government is supposed to be doing. Not only that, though, but when you look at the wording of, if you look at what Judge Bolton said, apparently if a cop pulls over a person in Arizona, if they're American, that's legal. So when you get pulled over and you're asked to show proof of license, registration and insurance, that is legal. They can do that to you. But apparently they cannot do the exact same thing when pulling over an illegal alien. Apparently by asking for proof of driver's license and everything else is not kosher. They can't do it. So basically even enforcing basic driving laws upon illegal aliens is now out of the realm of the police or the sheriff's department's ability. Because you can't ask them for ID. It's a violation of whatever rights that the federal government thinks that these people have. Now, let's remember that in the Constitution, and I don't care what Christina Aguilera says. I saw that bimbo on a news broadcast, and she's talking about the fact that the Constitution guarantees the rights and freedoms of all people. That's a lie. She's either stupid and has not read the damn thing, or she's lying, because it clearly states, American citizens, it's only for Americans. These laws, these rules, these freedoms that we have apply to us, not to foreign people, not to illegal aliens. I don't have a problem with illegal immigration. Hell, I don't have a problem with immigration. I got a problem with too much immigration. I have a problem with 1 million people coming into the country every year.
Well, in the 90s...
And there aren't any jobs for Americans as it is.
In the mid-90s, they passed new immigration laws. I mentioned that, and I think I might have given a date at the time. But back then, and you know, years ago, I tried to get a surveyor from Jamaica up to the United States. It took me 3 years. He was qualified. He was educated. He was a certified professional. He had 4 years of college. He had a family. He was from Jamaica. He had to meet quota requirements. He met the educational and professional and necessary job criteria, but it took 3 years to get him up here. And he came up on a temporary visa, which he could harden up later on if he stayed here and worked. So he worked for me for 3 years, and that was our deal, and then he was able to go on his own and get his Florida license and begin practicing survey himself. But it was a difficult process, and there were quotas from countries and all kinds of restrictions because you can't have a flood of people coming into the country. You have to have a controlled rate so that there's time for the people that come in to assimilate and become Americans. If you let massive amounts in, they'll create a little community like Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then it becomes a Mexican community because they did not assimilate into the American community of Albuquerque when they came up in the flood. Now, I've posted two links. The first one is Ashwander, which is the Supreme Court telling us that they don't rule on the constitutionality unless they have other, unless they can't find any way out of it. And the second one, who makes the laws? In 1946, Congress acknowledged that they were creating a fourth branch of government. It's in the congressional record, and it's astounding. And it fits with Ashwander because Ashwander was using administrative agencies to be the scapegoat. If you seek any benefit from an administrative agency, you're bound by the rules of the agency, regardless of what the Constitution says. So, in 1946, the Administrative Agencies Act strengthened the agencies, created a fourth branch of government, and allowed them, and it's been expanded since then, allowed them to begin writing rules, agency rules that are in effect laws, and they're the laws you're subject to. These are some of the overt things the government has done, not covert, overt things the government has done. They've admitted them in writing to diminish our Constitution and make it about worthless. You're pushing the petition, yes.
I was mentioning that in there, you know, and well, they mentioned that, you know, we have to shut down immigration. And, you know, Gary and I worked on a document called the You Have Treated Me petition. It's, you know, it's the olive branch petition. It's a final demand. It's a statement saying this is how it's going to be. This is what you're going to do. This is how we're going to resolve all the issues in the country. Everything is constitutional in there. It's all footnotes and referenced. But it brings about a five-year moratorium on immigration until we can determine what role immigration is going to play in the future of America. We can't handle any more immigrants right now. We don't have any jobs for Americans, and we're bringing in 1 million a year. If you get a chance, read that document. Fill it out. Sign it. Send it in. Do whatever. Let them know.
Yeah,
don't email it to them.
The jobs we do have here are either service-oriented or a war industry for the most part.
Prison.
Levi Strauss & Company, traditional American pants, rugged, used rivets and thread to make sure that they didn't tear at the pockets and at the joints and everything, are made in China now. The United Garment Workers industry was a fairly large union in this country. They didn't demand high wages. They just wanted steady employment. They made underwear and everything else. Look at your clothes. They're not even made in this country anymore. We have lost. A Pekingese dog is a Chinese breed that was bred out of its own ability to sustain itself in life. It has to be fed and nurtured by a human being. The United States has become a Pekingese dog. We cannot survive on our own anymore. We might be able to eat, but we wouldn't have anything to cook that food in. We can't produce. And immigration is not helping that because it forces people onto unemployment, and the immigration of jobs out of this country takes away the skilled labor of providing the things that we really need. And so we've got two forces working against each other. We're shipping the jobs away, pushing people into service-related industry or war industry, because all the agricultural is going to the foreign people. Now, the question, do you want cheap lettuce? I would rather pay more for the lettuce than have an American pick it, but then I think the American would also, once he left the union because there was no union job, ought to be willing to take less than $30 an hour to pick lettuce. So there's a balance, but that's called a free marketplace, and that's what made this country great. So anyway, shall we go back to reading these confusing, complex laws?
Let's finish up with the confusing complex laws and find out how it's illegal for the cops to even ask them for ID anymore. And, yeah, we can be stopped at any time for anything that we do, spitting on the sidewalk, proof of ID.
Okay, going on, permitting DHS to enter into agreements. It says DHS, but it said this attorney general in the law I read. She says permitting DHS. Now, I just got these off of Find Law, and they should be current. But she says permitting DHS, not the Attorney General, to enter in agreements whereby appropriate trained and supervised and local officials can perform certain immigration responsibilities. That means they have to come under our wing and believe that, you know, in essence, becoming deputized by the federal government. Establishing parameters for information sharing between state and local officials and federal immigration officials. Information sharing, cooperation, again, is rather confusing what cooperation means if it mandates that only one of the cooperators can make any decisions or if both can make decisions. And then Section 1252C, authorizing the state and local law enforcement officers to arrest aliens unlawfully present in the United States who have previously been convicted of a felony and deported. Okay, now this gets kind of interesting because it says previously been, let me find it. Oh, that's the one I couldn't find. She cited Section 1252C, and I didn't find a 1252C in the U.S. Code. So maybe it's a new one they just passed, maybe just in time for her to rule on it. That was the problem with that one. DHS has also established the Law Enforcement Support Center, LESC, which is administered by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and serves as the National Enforcement Information Center, answering queries from state and local officials regarding immigration status. So the federal government has